Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dollar.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you once again, Audrey, for getting us on the show. And I suppose we should say right away, shouldn't we, Audrey, that your friend Lucy from Great Britain was supposed to be here this week, but she's had a delay and won't be able to come over probably for at least 2 or 3 weeks. Nothing really wrong, ladies and gentlemen, but I think you'll enjoy Lucy when she joins Audrey and the rest of us for the show. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash again, as we always do, for taking us on that trip across 90 cities and states in the United States. And yes, he does sing that song from memory. Give it a try sometime. I'll bet you won't get it right on the first crack. All right, Emily, Mike, thank you for joining us tonight. No, Mike, I'm not going to destroy the chair. What is it, ladies and gentlemen, about these chairs that we buy that are made in some foreign country that won't adjust and stay properly adjusted? They end up dropping to the floor. I have one of those things, so be patient with me this evening. I promise not to destroy the chair, at least while we're on the air. All right, what we got here? This show is purpose. It has one, to discuss news, events, and issues and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Let me jump ahead for a moment. What we're going to do tonight for you novel writers, all two of you that are listening across the United States and the world, and one of my good friends just finished a novel, and we're going to have him on the show as soon as that book gets published. He sent it to me in advance, and it's very good. I enjoy very much reading that. I'm just about finished with it, and takes a little bit of stuff to get yourself a novel written. I noticed that Michael Savage just came out with his first novel, and you can go to his website and get that. I think it's called Abuse of Power, but I'll probably inhale that one also. But anyway, our show is dedicated to those tireless, energetic courts, police, corrections, juvenile justice officials that serve us throughout the United States and throughout the world. We try to look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, and I guess the shortest thing I can say about that is get your own show. You can actually do it. You can sign up literally within, I think, about 5 minutes now. I mean, they got a quick sign-up procedure. I think you can be broadcasting worldwide, any person in the interest group, on any subject you want that's legal, of course. Oh, I never thought about that. I guess the criminals could have a show. Oh, no, I think Alan Levy wouldn't permit that. He's the executive and the genius behind this marvelous medium called Blog Talk Radio. But you can get signed up almost in no time, and you're on the air and broadcasting to an unlimited number of listeners worldwide, and it doesn't cost you a penny. Imagine even suggesting this in the year 2000 or 1990 or something like that. Well, tonight we're going to get started on a number of things. Let's go ahead and take a look at, some of the criminal justice news. Maybe I'll hold off on that. Let's do our green tip first. This is a good one tonight. You know, I've never had a cat, you know, a kitty, a kitten, however cat owners refer to them. I've never had a cat, but Esma Floyd, in the book 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, has a tip number 915 out of 1001. It says, keep a kitty. And this tip says, keep your cat indoors overnight. Roaming house cats do tremendous damage to birds and other wildlife, such as field mice, frogs, squirrels, and lizards. And they can cover long distances in one night, so keep them in the best option. Keep them inside. That's the best option. I never thought about that. Keep your cat inside. Cats like to go a lot of places, don't they? Aren't a lot of cats, you know, a lot of people think they own cats when, in fact, the cats actually got about six owners and everybody thinks it's their cat. I've always heard that about a cat. I don't know. But I don't see as many cats. Maybe I'm not looking for cats lately, but I don't see as many of them around as I used to, but I'm sure they're more popular than ever. Cute little creatures, and they come in all sizes and shapes. And do they have an international cat show? They must, just like the dog show and all that business. But anyway, keep your kitty inside at night. It will make the environment a lot better. All right, let's take a look at Audrey's blonde joke for tonight. And that's going to be a good one. And Audrey, go ahead. Let's see what very appropriate this one tonight. Go ahead. Audrey, by the way, is a blonde from Great Britain, and she's been collecting blonde jokes since a child. She's not offended by blonde jokes. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, this blonde joke is so blonde. I mean so blonde. I think our listeners will really enjoy it. Here it is. Two blonde ladies were sipping their Starbucks when a truck went past loaded up with rolls of sod. I'm going to do that when I win the lottery, announced blonde number one. Do what? Asked blonde number two. Send my lawn away to be mowed.
I'm not sure people understand that thoroughly, but she saw a load of sod, rolled up sod, rolls on truck going by. And she makes enough money, she wants to have her lawn done the same way, send it out to be mowed. Oh, that's a good one. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, how appropriate, and we do this every week. The Haya Coalition Against Firearms would like you to hear this public service announcement and take heed. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not for you. It's for the criminals on the street, I'm sure. I mean, they certainly would be directing a message like that to us. We law-abiding citizens. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we appreciate doing that public service announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, let's take a look at some of the news tonight in criminal justice. I mean, there's always about 20,000 articles that we could be looking at, but there's some good ones. There are some good ones here tonight. And, Mike, I don't know if you want to read some of these. I'll just summarize them. But let's take a look at some of these things as soon as I can get it up here on my screen. One of these is kind of interesting. It has to do with dismantling the TSA. The Transportation Security Agency. The article starts out by saying they've been accused of rampant thievery. They spend billions of dollars like drunken sailors. They grope children and little old ladies and make everyone take off their shoes. But the real job of the tens of thousands of screeners at TSA is to protect people from terrorist attack. You're sure? Yes, they did. Yet a decade after the TSA was created, following September 11th, 2001, we just passed the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary, the author of the legislation he says that the message agency has some problems. The whole program's been hijacked by bureaucrats, says John Mica, Republican of Florida, chairman of the House Transportation Committee. It mushroomed into an army, Mica said. It's gone from a couple $1 billion to, are you sitting down, folks, $9 billion business. As for keeping the American public safe, they failed to actually detect any threat in 10 years. That's a couple of ways of looking at that, but let's be fair about it. Everything that they've done has been reactive. They take shoes off because the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, passenger padded down because of the diaper bomber, and you can't pack liquid because the British uncovered a plot using liquid. It's an agency that is always one step out of step. It cost $1 billion to train the workers, which now number more than 62,000, and they actually train more workers than they have jobs. That's interesting. The whole thing is a complete fiasco. Instead, he said the agency should number no more than 5,000 and carry out the original intent, which was to monitor terrorist threats and collect intelligence. The fledgling agency was quickly engulfed in its first scandal in 2002 as it rushed to hire 30,000 screeners, and the $104 million awarded to the company to contract workers quickly escalated to $740 million. Federal investigators tracked those cost overruns to recruiting sessions held at swank hotels and resorts in St. Croix, the Virgin Islands, Florida, and Wyndham Peaks Resort and Golden Door Spa, and Telluride, I guess that they pronounced that, Colorado. Charges of hundreds of thousands of dollars were made for cash withdrawals, valet parking and beverages, plus $5 million salary for one executive for 9 months of work. Can you believe that? Working for a government, $5.4 million. Some other expenditures, like $8,000 for elevator operators at a hotel, $2,000 for 20 gallons of Starbucks coffee. It goes on and on and on and on, but it's kind of crazy, isn't it? I suppose related to that, here's another article. They just caught some TSA officers, three federal TSA officers, and two other law enforcement officers were arrested on charges of accepting cash or gift cards in exchange for permitting prescription drug dealers to move tens of thousands of highly addictive painkillers and cash proceeds from the illegal sales to airports and highways. That won't go on, but the TSA officers worked at airports in Florida and New York, and a Westchester County, New York police officer allowed the oxycodone through airport security, authorities said Tuesday. A Florida state trooper accepted cash and checks for ensuring dealers could freely transport the pills and cash products by their car through the state. Isn't that incredible? My gosh, I hope these folks end up in jail for doing something like that. It does say they can get as many as, the five of them can get as many as 20 years in prison for doing that. But nothing like that should actually happen. I mean, we should have people in the business like that. But good old TSA. No, I'm not knocking them, really. They do a job. They've always been polite to me, even when they held me up 45 minutes for having a tablet PC that they'd never laid eyes on once in Denver. But anyway, have you heard about the young woman in Texas? I guess she's in the El Paso area. Let me see if I can bring this up in a little larger screen, but anyway, I know the story. She is, how old is she? 18. It's Angie Gomez. She has been faking having leukemia for, I guess, at least a couple of years. And in the process of faking having leukemia, I guess she was a really good actress because she collected $17,000 in donations to send to Leukemia Foundation or for the charity, except the money went to a bank account that she created. And then finally, near the end of this, some people that knew her were a little bit suspicious that maybe she was faking it. She graduated this past June. Gomez told a tale of having leukemia as a child and was now fighting a fatal resurgence of the cancer. She She told her classmates that doctors in January had given her just 6 months to live. Classmates and teachers at the high school rallied around her and held fundraisers, and then she was invited to speak at other schools. It goes on and on, but they finally have caught her. People would actually drop her off at the hospital for cancer treatments, and she'd go to the front door, I guess, out the back, or wait till they took off. But she faked this for quite a while. So I'm thinking she might go to prison for something like this. It seems like it would be appropriate. And she would be old enough, because in Texas you're an adult at age 17. Well, speaking of the government at work, I didn't say that, but Michigan, in an attempt to combat Michigan's childhood obesity epidemic, I'm so sick of hearing about that, Governor Rick Snyder announced Wednesday that the state would begin tracking kids' body mass index through the Michigan Care Improvement Registry. Although the policy would be one of the most extensive government anti-child obesity efforts ever, pediatricians were divided over whether it would have the desired impact. And they're saying, well, you know, if we start collecting the weight and the BMI stuff, that this will cause parents at home and others in schools to start talking about childhood obesity and do something about it. And these other doctors have come in and said, you know, well, obesity, okay, but, you know, when a kid's 9 or 10, you know, they sort of grow out of it. It's kind of a thing for young girls, particularly, don't they? Some of them a little overweight, and then, you know, everything gets straightened out later on. But some worry that discussing obesity in terms of BMI with parents and kids will be misleading, as tracking BMI does not reflect positive changes overweight kids can make in their activity level. So this is something that they're probably going to do, but sounds like big government to me. And I don't get this. I know it's probably bad to be overweight or considerably overweight or whatever, but it ain't my business, is it? I mean, some people like being overweight. I've known people considerably overweight that as old as I am, and that's old as the hills, and they're still there. So maybe they like being overweight. You know, what are we going to do? Get all the sumo wrestlers to stop eating? I don't get it for sure, but who knows? I'm going to go back to one more TSA. The TSA now is going to stop having children take their shoes off at the airport. We were one of the last six nations of the world that still required little kids to take off their shoes at the airport, and we're not going to do any more groping of little children. Remember the little four-year-old girl, whatever she was, the picture that was all over the place in the news. We're not going to be doing that, which is pretty good. I thought this was an interesting story. Prison guards in California, no, they've been caught smuggling cell phones to prisoners. Did that ever happen? But Governor Jerry Brown, he's going to do something about it. A California prison guard has been indicted on six counts of taking bribes from inmates to smuggle tobacco and cell phones. I think I told you, one of my students that knows a lot about this in the higher prison says that a cigarette goes for about $5 now in prison. One cigarette, not one pack, for $5. What's a pack cost, Mike? It's about $5, isn't it? So one cigarette in prison goes for about the same price as a pack of cigarettes. This guy, federal grand jury in Sacramento, says Bobby Joe Kirby of Reno, Nevada, took nearly $16,000 to sneak the contraband into the California Correctional Center in Susanville. The minimum security prison trains inmates to fight wildfires. That's a good idea. Well, inmates need to be doing stuff. I hope they're fighting some, as opposed to just being trained to do some. But Kirby, who's 55, he's free on $25,000 bond after his arrest this past June, and he'll be charged. He faces up to 20 years in federal prison if convicted. Now, here's something I don't understand. Can any of you three explain this to me? Governor Jerry Brown is considering legislation making such smuggling a misdemeanor to fight the growing problem of phones behind bars. Anybody understand that? I'm not saying it must be a felony, I would think, for a prison guard to do smuggling. But he's saying making a misdemeanor is actually not even against the law. He's starting with a misdemeanor to do that. Well, Governor Jerry Brown, I've always been a big fan of Governor Jerry Brown. I'm on the opposite end of the political spectrum, but he's always been an interesting guy, and I suspect an honest person. And how many offices in California has he held? I mean, you probably can't count. He was even mayor of Oakland, wasn't he, once? Wouldn't want that job. Well, I'm sorry, Oakland people. It's a great place. But he wants to consider making smuggling a misdemeanor to fight the growing problem of phones behind bars. Why would prisoners want phones? Oh, they could continue to run their criminal operations from behind bars. They could do all kinds of things. Well, I'm seeing more and more people talking to their phone, and their people they're talking to are on full screen. Their little cell phone. I see people walking around now. It used to be dangerous enough that they're walking around talking on a cell phone or driving. Now they're holding up the phone and looking at the picture or video of the person that they're talking to. So that's got to be another example of distracted or maybe really distracted driving. You know, once the person you're talking to is sticking her tongue out to you or something, you get mad at them. You take your eyes off the road. But that's something. We didn't talk about this last week because it's dated the 12th, so I guess we're okay. But Wisconsin became the 19th, the 49th state to allow concealed carry. So if you go through the background checks and whatever type of training and other requirements they have in Wisconsin, now you can carry guns and even carry them on university campuses. But guess what? The universities are going to make rules that you can't take them. University of Wisconsin at Madison, they're going to announce signs that you cannot bring the guns in any university building. In other words, you probably take it to the parking lot, and that's probably it. And that really kind of defeats the purpose of, the process to start with. So we'll have to see how that turns out. I don't know if they still do it, but Wisconsin used to be the state where a business owner could not have a firearm on his own property. Or her own property. Can you believe that? In other words, I got a little carry out or a bakery or whatever, and to defend myself in case people ever come in and rob me, which happens, I'm not even allowed to have a firearm on my property. Wisconsin is also the place that connects in. I don't know if other states do that or how many do, but they connect in like in bars. They have cameras that the police can tap into, and they can watch and see who's drinking too much and maybe heading for the parking lot and getting their car, that type of thing. So that's kind of an interesting idea. People are asking for a national CCW again. That's dated the 12th. People are suggesting that, why don't we, instead of these states having reciprocal agreements, Ohio, for example, if you have a CCW, I forget how many states there are, 7, 9, 10, 11 or something, you're allowed to carry in that state, and then that state's CCW holders can carry in Ohio. So these states have all these different reciprocal agreements, but you get confused. In fact, somebody just told me about that. They went on vacation, and they're going, two of them, their husband and wife, are going on vacation, and they have CCW licenses. They're not sure the state that they go into, whether or not they're right. Now, I think the National Rifle Association website tries to keep up on that. And then what's the other, I'm sorry, folks, I can't remember the name of the one, something else, concealed carry. Another big national website, very well done, good information on there. But they list the reciprocal agreements also. So it would be a little simpler since we've got, 236 million guns? Some say we've got 280 now. Who knows how many guns there are. But it's confusing for people that want to carry a gun to protect themselves. Well, that's it for the news news tonight. I switched things on you. If you looked at the billing for the show ahead of time, we were going to discuss, and I have not done this since I started the show, because everybody wants to talk about murder and serial murders, and I just stay away from it. I know so many people, and there are college students that are almost obsessed with this particular subject. I was finally going to do a story where a news guy and a detective from Baltimore wrote this book called Why People Kill. they had all the stuff up on the site and the video audio. And then today I checked, and the audio and the stuff is still up there, but the audio and video is gone. So I don't know if there was something in the presentation that people didn't like or what. But what we're going to do is do something about writing novels. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have a very fine gentleman come in and talk about his novel and writing novels about Charlie Chan. And this is Yuntae Huang, and he's a professor at the University of California, in the University of California system. He's taught at Yale and some other places. He's going to talk about a character called Chang Chung Apanya in Hawaii, who lived somewhere between like 1870 and 1870-something, 1930, and he's the person that spawned the idea. I mean, he's the character that led to the Charlie Chan novels. And if you haven't read a Charlie Chan novel, I think I did a long time ago, they're very interesting stories. In fact, I think some of those Charlie Chan shows are actually on archive.org, which is a wonderful site. So we're going to go ahead and start that, and bear with us to make sure we get this thing rolling and get it right. But those of you who are novel writers, the author's going to talk right away about how he had writer's block for a couple of years. He moved to California to do writing, thought it would be better there, and he sat on the beach for 2 years and essentially wrote nothing. So writing a novel is not the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's a very interesting process. It's description and reflection and dialogue, and we'll see how this gentleman talks to us about it. Okay, hold on just a second.
An English professor's latest book looks at a Hawaiian detective who was the basis for the fictional novel and movie character Charlie Chan. D.G. Wilf Books in La Jolla, California hosts this hour-long talk.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Dennis. And I would really want to thank D.G. Wells, the great bookstore here, for hosting this event. Secondly, I want to say I'm really happy to be back in California. Now, some of you may know that I'm spending the year visiting Cornell University. As beautiful as Ithaca Fall is, I really miss California. I remember when I first moved to Santa Barbara 7 years ago from Cambridge, Massachusetts, I was sitting on the beach every day. And I was really bored. I thought I was, coming to California to be a writer on the beach, but I had ended up having a writer's block for 2 years. Slowly but surely, the land of Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald grew on me. And when I began to look at the landscape, through the lens of this master detective writer, even Orange Groves, require some sort of kind of hard-boiled lingo in which I feel strangely at home. But tonight I'm going to talk about another master detective, an unusual one for that matter. Through him, I don't just see California, I see America. So my plan is I'm going to read a very short excerpt for about like 5 minutes, and then I'm going to talk for anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes, and then before, returning to reading another very short, excerpt. There should be enough time for Q&A. So the piece I'm going to read first takes us back over 100 years in history. On a balmy July night in 1904, a wiry waif of a man sauntered alone through the dim alleys of Honolulu's Chinatown. A mere 5 feet tall, with intense shoulders and a ramrod straight back, the man was wearing a Canton Police blouse, threadbare trousers, and a Panama hat. A pair of dark glasses, a sear the scar above his eye. His upper lip, blackened by burned cork, gave the impression that he needed a shave. From a distance, he was unmistakably Chinese, barely distinguishable as he walked among the shuffling throng of his countrymen. The hot, southerly corner weather, which had piled the breakers high along the coast and sapped the spirit out of every living being, had departed the island by sundown. A gentle trade wind blowing in from the northeast had brought renewed energy to the city. A local boy was plucking soft tunes on his ukulele, perhaps down on the moonlit beach not far below the street, fringed with coconut palms and licked by the lazy surf. When the serenade paused, a cock miner gave out a clear floated cry, ruffling its plumage beneath the canopy of a perfumed night. Under the sickle moon, the Chinaman reached the corner of Smith Street in the heart of Chinatown. He slowed his pace on the darkened street, where shops and the restaurants displayed cardboard signs scrawled in his native language. They had shut their doors much earlier, except one nondescript building where he saw a glint of light escaping through an upstairs window. A faint snarl flickered at the corners of his mouth. He drew a deep breath. The night air was a strange melange of odor that lingered from the oil wok and the salty tang of the Pacific wind. Through the unlit front gate, he stepped cautiously inside the building and passed by the doorman undetected. He did the same at the next 3 doors, each guarded by someone, each leading him deeper into what seemed like a maze of Chinese boxes. Climbing up the rickety stairs to the 2nd floor, he turned and faced a room packed with gamblers, all Chinese, humming over games of fantan, haigao, craps, and mahjong. The air was a mix of smothered smoke, the den ringing with curses, jeers, and the sound of clicking dice in the mahjong piles. He observed the ballyhoo through his dark lenses. Someone at the mahjong table looked up and immediately recognized the face of the infamous cop whose name elicited shudders from the spines of Honolulu criminals. Chai Mo! Before the Taiwanese cry for help dropped to the ground, a 5-foot bullet had uncoiled like hissing rattlesnake from the detective's waist. One crisp snap of the whip and the entire room froze like a gambling hall diorama under glass. Only clouds of cigarette smoke still wavered, the afterthoughts of exploded firecrackers, not sure where to settle in the deafening silence. Many there had already heard of, and some had even tasted, the might of this unusual weapon wielded by the former rough riding Pagnolo. Resisting arrest would be futile, even though they knew he had, as usual, brought no backup. His wit had spoken louder than any law or gun. Telling them the jig was up, the Chinaman, known to the locals as Connor Poon, lined up the gamblers, 40 in all, and marched them out of the room and down to the police station on Bethel Street. Not a single shot was fired. Connor Poon's real name was Chang Apana. An officer of the Honolulu Police Department, he will later acquire a more fascinating moniker, Charlie Chan. His colorful exploits, like the bravado on this July night, would one day draw the attention of mainland novelist Earl Dare Biggers. From 1925 onward, a total of 6 novels and a 47 films, in addition to radio programs, newspaper comics, and countless full fortune cookie witticisms, would make Charlie Chan, upon a fictional double, one of the most enduring cultural icons of 20th century America. As some of you may know, some of you especially who have read the book or either the reviews out there, will know that in this book, I'm trying to tie up several loose ends, each of which is a story. As Charlie Chan would say, truth, like football, receives many kicks before reaching goal. So in order to solve this, Charlie Chan mystery, I need to give this football truth several kicks. With each kick, hopefully gaining me kind of different yardage, if not mileage. The first kick is, of course, the story of Chang Apana, the real Charlie Chang, this rough and tumble Hawaiian cowboy. Just to tell his story very briefly, he was born in Hawaii around 1871. He went his father was a coolie laborer, you know, from Canton, who came to work on sugarcane plantation. At the age of three, Aparna went to China with his parents. He grew up in the same district as actually Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the founding father of the Republic of China, who also actually came of age later on in Honolulu. They actually overlap, Aparna and Sun Yat-sen. Anyway, at the age of 10, Aparna came back to Hawaii with his uncle. He became a paniolo, that's the Hawaiian word for cowboy, and worked at ranches. He joined the police force in 1898, just when Hawaii was annexed by the United States. He almost immediately became, you know, a local legend, because as a police officer, he would walk the most dangerous beats in Chinatown, carrying a bullwhip that, you know, he had made himself. He was a master of disguise. He was actually the first undercover cop for that department. He could single-handedly, as I, you know, read in the prologue, could single-handedly arrest 40 people without firing a shot. So, as an illiterate man, the son of a coolie laborer, you know, if we could use the, you know, the parlance of the 19th century, he was really a man, you know, who would have stood no Chinaman's chance, for that matter. And yet, you know, he made a name for himself and became the inspiration for the fictional Charlie Chan. The second kick, or the second story I'm trying to tell in the book, is about Earl the Bigger. And that's another, to me, you know, coming from China, that's another amazing American story. This, you know, young black guy from Ohio with no family connection, and yet, you know, he managed to get into Harvard and became a best-selling author. Bigger was born in Warren, Ohio, in 1884, and his parents actually had to borrow money to send him to Harvard. And he did pretty well. He joined the, you know, Lampoon, Signia Club, and Advocate, and all these societies. And after his graduation, he went to Harvard in 1903. His last year actually overlapped with T.S. Eliot. Anyway, after he graduated from Harvard, his first job was a night police, you know, reporter for a Cleveland Plain Dealer, a newspaper in Cleveland. He was almost immediately fired because the editor soon found out that he was a much better storyteller than a journalist. So, especially when the matter is police matter, when you made up stories, you know. But in a strange way, we really have to thank, you know, Cleveland Plain Dealer for upholding such high standards of journalism. You know, otherwise, you know, had Biggers, you know, kept his job, that may have not have been Charlie Chan at all, for that matter. So as Charlie Chan would say, you know, door of opportunity swing both ways, you know, and this is America. Anyway, so Biggers turned to the writing of mystery novels after, you know, he lost that job. His very first important book was the mystery novel, Seven Keys to Border Fate, published in 1913. As a writer, Biggers had a thing for keys, you know, for the title. First one is Seven Keys to Border Fate, the first Charlie Chan novel, The House Without a Key, and later on another Charlie Chan novel, Keeper of the Key, you know, again. The success of Seven Keys to Border Fate propelled him into national limelight, but he was soon overworked, so he had to take a vacation in Hawaii. And it was on the beach of, you know, Waikiki, as the story goes, that he first came up with the idea of a Charlie Chan novel. But to be honest, you know, the first Charlie Chan novel with The House Without a Key was not really strictly a Charlie Chan novel, because, you know, the detective does not appear until about one-third into the book. And he really started out as a minor character, like the third man, the Chinaman. But obviously his charm was irresistible. And as soon as the book was published, readers clamored for more Charlie Chan books in which the character, you know, the detective would be a central character. Therefore, the Chan dynasty, you know, began in 1925. And this is the third story I want to tell in the book. It's really about the making of Charlie Chan, the iconic Chinaman. We could say the timing of Charlie Chan's birth could not have been any better or worse, depending how you look at it. Because in 1924, the year before then, the United States had just passed the infamous Johnson Reed Act, the anti-immigration bill, basically. The bill was targeting the Irish, Southern Europeans like Italians, or Eastern Europeans, and all Asians. So it was a turning point in American culture when the country literally closed its door to the so-called foreigners. And there you go, there's one lovely, funny, wisecracking foreigner, stumbling on stage. The question is, why is that? We should understand, despite the fact the 20s was probably one of the most xenophobic eras, in American history, some people may argue today it is actually another one. Despite that, America always had this long-lasting love or craze, for the Orient or for Asia. So you can just recall, for instance, people like, Ernest Fenollosa, even Henry Adams or John Lafarge, or Lafcadio Hearn, who went to Japan and China and brought back, art and literature, and everything, from the Orient. So Orientalism was, in the air. So we have to acknowledge that. And therefore, Charlie Chan, was born in this very strange period when, xenophobia and xenophilia, were tied together like Siamese twins in many ways. And Hollywood, which can never forget Hollywood, or have enough of it, which had just begun to grab the lion's share of American popular imagination, very soon, jumped on what I would call, the Charlie Chan bandwagon. But we should remember, and this is a kind of a little known fact, actually, that the first three actors who played Charlie Chan in the silent film era were not white. They were Asian, two Japanese and one Korean. But somehow they didn't have enough star power to make the character a success. And especially the last one, E.L. Park, that movie, Behind the Curtain. In that movie, if you forgive my, my pun, that Charlie Chan literally fell off the picture. Because in this one-hour film, Charlie Chan appears for no more than a minute. So, but anyway, it wasn't until, Warner Olin, this great Swedish actor who had made a name for himself. In this 1927, Al Jolson's jazz singer.
Well, it looks like we've lost Professor Huang for good. I've tried a number of things here in different browsers, and we can't bring him up. C-SPAN must be really loaded. It's a great resource. It has thousands of books on there in audio and video form, but unfortunately this one we've lost. So we'll just go ahead and sign off tonight and join us next week, and we won't be on Vogue TV for a while. Okay. Thank you.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling too, just like you always do. The blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again someday.